Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by John Cullerton, Illinois State Senate President, conservative Roger Keats, liberal Salim Muakil, and writer Carol Felsenthal. Our program tonight coming to you from our studios, the Sirius XM studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. For much of our program this evening, we're going to be talking about the inauguration of President Barack Obama last week and his first week in office. But we'll also be talking at the beginning of our program about a story breaking late in the week and dominating still some national talk shows, and that is Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Tomorrow at 12 noon in the state capital in the state of Illinois, the Illinois State Senate will meet and they will begin the trial of Governor Blagojevich, who was impeached as a huge vote against him by the Illinois House just a couple of weeks ago. And yet the governor has chosen to go and to wage war and to take his case to the public in the court of public opinion. He was on numerous talk shows in Chicago last week. He also held a press conference, and he said that he is eager to get his story out. However, he will not be in Springfield tomorrow when the trial begins because he believes the Senate trial rules violate his rights.
As much as I'd love to participate in the Senate trial and in the Senate process, under the current rules that the Senate provides, they're not allowing me to participate in that process. To participate in a process that denies fundamental fairness, fundamental due process, to be part of a process that doesn't allow for calling of witnesses, and worse than that, doesn't allow for me or any citizen to challenge charges that are brought against me, is a fundamental violation of the Constitution. It is a trampling of the Constitution.
Joining us now is the man who will be in the spotlight tomorrow in the Senate. He is the newly elected president of the Illinois State Senate, Democrat from Chicago, John Cullerton. Senator, nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Bruce.
Mr. President, when you take that gavel tomorrow, what are the basic rules in place that the people of Illinois should understand?
Well, it's a trial. The House impeached the governor. We are obligated under the Constitution to have a trial. We had to draft rules. So we looked to President Clinton's trial, the most recent major impeachment trial, and we adopted those rules as our model. We drafted those rules, 6 hours of testimony, about 150, most of those were conducted about 150 feet from the governor's office on the 16th floor of the state capitol building in Chicago. He did not come down and weigh in on the fairness of those rules. Nobody was there from the governor's office. These are the rules that applied during the Clinton trial that resulted in an acquittal of President Clinton. They are fair. They're different than a criminal case, but they certainly give the governor the right to call any witnesses that he wants. He himself can come. He would probably be the most important witness. And instead of doing Larry King Live, we'd like him to come to his own trial. The only thing that
he can cross-examine witnesses?
Absolutely. He can have his own lawyer there. He's a lawyer himself. He could come and cross-examine, represent himself. The only limitation we had was a result of the U.S. Attorney, Patrick Fitzgerald, told the House that they could not subpoena certain witnesses involved in the criminal investigation of the governor. If they want to come voluntarily, they could certainly still come. So we put in our rules that you can't subpoena those witnesses because otherwise Fitzgerald would go to court. It would block
us from doing it. Your side can't do it and he can't do it.
That's correct. So, for example, the prosecution, when you say our side, we're the judges. The House is the one who's doing the prosecution. The House prosecutor, they might want to call Tony Rezko or someone else, Stuart Levine, or somebody that would be very critical of the governor potentially, but they can't do that either. So that's what the governor's referring to. He talked about, you know, there's five charges that he has. There's 13 total charges against him. Five of them have nothing to do with his criminal case. Certainly he could come in and tell us his side of the story on those charges. And on the criminal matter, He referred specifically to Rahm Emanuel. Why can't Rahm Emanuel? I can't call Rahm Emanuel because he was on Face the Nation, said some things that I thought would be helpful to me. Well, he could, without having Rahm Emanuel there, without subpoenaing Rahm Emanuel, could have the tape of Face the Nation interview and have that introduced. So he's totally misreading these rules, and as a result, he's missing the opportunity to come into his own trial and defend himself.
Is he misreading them, or is he deliberately muddying the waters because he feels that he may not do well, at least in that trial, and he's saving himself for a trial that conceivably could send him to prison?
Well, again, I can see where he would want to protect his rights in his criminal trial by not testifying in front of our impeachment trial as it relates to the criminal matters. But there's other charges, as I mentioned, that he could defend himself on. And if he doesn't defend himself in this trial, then it's going to be more difficult for him to avoid being removed from office. In spite of the fact that he's not coming, believe me, all the senators are taking this very seriously. And there's an obvious reason for that. There's an obvious reason why there's been only one impeachment in 7 years of a governor. You don't do this frivolously. We all, as elected officials, are subject to the same precedents and the same rules. So we're not going to make it easy to just go in there and whimsically remove somebody from public office when the same thing could be turned against us. It's a selfish motivation, but it's an obvious fact. And that's why he should realize this is we're taking this very seriously. He should definitely come and defend himself.
Illinois House Member Jack Franks, who's been on a lot of national television shows, he led the charge in the House for the impeachment. He has basically said this is a political trial. It's all politics. Do you agree that it's just all politics?
No. That's perhaps not the best way to phrase it. We are talking about not his life or liberty. We're talking about his job. It's a political job, if you will. He's an elected official. This is the way certain elected officials are removed from office if they cannot perform their job anymore, if they've abused the office. This is how we do it. Okay? So, yes, there's an element of politics when the senators are voting, but it's also a trial at the same time. It's not a criminal trial. There's different rules, but it's nonetheless a trial. And there has to be 40 out of 59 senators decide to take the very serious step of removing a governor who had been elected by the people. So we take it seriously, and I just have to tell you, I can't believe that the governor thinks he's doing the right thing here because he should be there defending himself.
Were you stunned by anything you heard him say this past week in Chicago on either the interviews or his press conference?
Well, yes, but I'm not going to comment on some of the things he said because it might relate to this trial, and we've also, in our rules, we're not supposed to speculate. But I would just say I'm stunned that he misread the rules. Assuming that he has. He's saying things that are just not true concerning these rules. He specifically mentioned my name as being somebody who's being unfair. And, you know, we did this in a bipartisan way. We unanimously voted for these rules. They resulted in the impeachment, in the acquittal of Bill Clinton, and they're fair.
We're talking to the president of the Illinois State Senate, John Cullerton, Democrat from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. He's our special guest in the first couple of segments this evening. Later on, we'll be expanding our discussion to talk more about this issue and also about President Barack Obama and his first week in office. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago with John Cullerton. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. Our guest is the president of the Illinois State Senate, Democrat John Cullerton of Chicago, who tomorrow at 12 o'clock will be in Springfield for the trial of Governor Rod Blagojevich. And as the Senate president, what specific role will you have tomorrow?
Well, Bruce, actually, I'm we say jurors, but we're more akin to judges because we actually get to vote on evidentiary matters, unlike a normal juror. So we're kind of like mini judges. There's 59 of us. I don't preside. The Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court presides, and we will begin tomorrow. We've already actually begun by being sworn in. We've started the pleading stage where the governor could have had the opportunity to file an appearance and file motions to dismiss, and he didn't choose to do that. So tomorrow when we start, there'll be motions, there'll be opening statements by the prosecutor, the House prosecutor, And then we'll start the with the witnesses.
I want to clarify something that you said in segment one, and that is that as this trial process has begun, the governor has totally ignored all communication with the state Senate?
Yes, that's correct. He had an opportunity. He was served. He knows that it's going on. He had an opportunity with deadlines to list witnesses that he wants to bring in, motions to dismiss certain parts of the allegations that were leveled against him. He's totally divorced himself from it, and he's chosen not to participate.
So he ignores the process and then says the process is unfair.
Right, and as I said before, when we were drafting these rules, he certainly was aware. We had public hearings. We had about 6 hours. We had witnesses come in, test from lawyers, citizens, talking about the rules. You know, we could have changed the rules. We could have made them differently. We talked about whether what we should have in the rules, and we decided, as I said, to have the model be the Clinton rules because that was viewed as being fair. It resulted in an acquittal.
Those people around the United States who have been following this story are following the story because of some of the profanity-laced tapes or transcripts that they heard referenced by Patrick Fitzgerald shortly after the arrest and the initial charges were made against the governor for allegations that he was trying to sell the Senate seat of Barack Obama. That's sort of the national imprint or black mark that is on Rod Blagojevich. But that charge isn't even included in what the Illinois State Senate's going to be dealing with, or is it?
Well, again, I'll be very careful. I don't want to talk about the evidence that might be presented. I can just tell you that there's 13...
But is it one of the charges?
Well, there's 8 charges that are related to the criminal investigation of the governor, and one of those criminal investigations clearly is into whether or not he was selling the Senate seat. There's an allegation that he got money or was trying to get money from a horse racing industry in exchange for signing a bill. There's another one about signing a bill or releasing money to children's hospitals in exchange for campaign contributions. Those are included in the public record that the House has sent over to us.
So there are many other charges that those who will sit in judgment of the governor are aware of, they will have evidence on, and yet these are not things that in the court of public opinion, people listening to this program or watching this program all over the United States have heard much about. And again, as we look at how the governor is going to be interviewed tomorrow when he's on The View or on the Today Show or on Good Morning America or on with Larry King, it may very well be that that any of the specifics in those charges will not even be brought up by the reporters.
Well, that's very possible because they're not familiar with the details of the House impeachment trial, of the House impeachment charges. And that's what we're going to be there listening to the evidence while he's doing interviews off someplace else other than where his own trial's going on. He's not, defending himself in the court where he's supposed to be. That's all we're saying. And I'm particularly offended, quite frankly, by the fact that he would suggest that these rules are unfair when he's misstating what they do. They are clear. They resulted in the acquittal of Clinton, the same basic rules, and he's urged once again to change his mind, to come back to Springfield and defend himself.
Explain the math of the trial. How many votes do you need does the Senate need to convict him?
Again, the prosecution is done by the House. They're the ones that have their House prosecutor come over. They made the charges. We have got to have the trial, obligated by the Constitution, and we then hear the evidence, we deliberate, all of this is open, it's all going to be on television, and we have an open vote. If we vote to remove the governor from office, 40 of us out of 59 have to do that. There's 37 Democrats, there's 22 Republicans. It's not a partisan issue. It hasn't come that way so far. The rules were adopted unanimously. It's an individual senator's choice. Even the standard of proof, as in Clinton, that each individual senator uses is their own individual, whether it be preponderance of the evidence or beyond a reasonable doubt. It's up to the individual senator to make that decision.
Now, we should mention for those listening around the country, Governor Blagojevich obviously is your governor because you're a resident of Illinois, as he is mine, but you are his state senator.
He lives 2 blocks from me. I see him all the time jogging down our street because he runs every morning, as people in America now know. And I've known him since he was first elected in 1990, one as a state representative.
And what is the personal and professional relationship that you've had with him over the years?
Well, we've been, as most people in Illinois know, we've had a rocky relationship with the governor. The General Assembly and the governor have not gotten along. He has chosen to kind of fight us and not engage with us as much as we certainly would have liked to. I've been here 30 years. The previous 24 years had been with Republican governors and who had a much better relationship with the General Assembly.
Now, again, in his public utterances last week, he made a big point that it was he basically doing his job, fighting for the little guy, doing all the things that he said he was going to do during his campaign, and it is the big, bad, greedy, General Assembly that's conspiring against him because they want to get him out of office because they want to raise taxes. I don't expect you to comment on that because, again, it's part of his MO. But, again, this is the type of thing we will hear more of. Not only in the public appearances that are going to be tomorrow, he's going to be on the Today Show, Good Morning America, Larry King, and The View. That's all tomorrow. He's done a round of talk show hosts or talks with talk show hosts in Chicago last Friday following his press conference. And so I would suspect that he may be keeping up this battle in the court of public opinion while you and your colleagues are laboring in Springfield.
Bruce, I'm telling you, because of the precedent-setting nature of this, we are taking this seriously. We are going to divorce ourselves from these personal either friendships or fights that people have had with him. We're going to listen to the evidence. Even in his lack of a defense, we're going to have the opportunity to ask questions ourselves, to do our own cross-examination, to make sure that we're doing the right thing if we chose to remove him. So he's going to get a fair trial even in his absence. And all of these diversions, if you will, are inexplicable because they don't help him explain his case to who he has to explain it to, the people that are judging him, the Illinois state senators.
It has been suggested that what the governor is trying to do by going public in the court of public opinion is that he may be trying to build a political groundswell that will be pressure on the members of the state Senate so that when they go back to their respective districts, they're going to be dealing with irate people who have been stirred up by the governor and maybe the governor's supporters. Is that something that you are aware of? Do you believe that will happen? And what is being done to sort of protect the senators and to insulate them from any persuasion one way or the other?
Well, that comes back to the point you made about the Representative Franks made. It's a political trial in that the vote that you take is a public vote, just like when you vote for a piece of legislation. And so we are elected officials, and I guess in the back of your mind is the idea of, is this an easy vote or a tough vote? What should I vote? Are there political consequences for my vote? The answer would be yes. So that would work both ways. If the governor is hated by certain people and the senator is from that district, he says, I can't vote for this guy. I've got to vote against him. That might be a factor. And if he's loved or has generated some love through the airwaves that he's using tomorrow or the next day, that might be a factor as well. But I can just tell you that we are sworn to do justice, and that would involve acting the way you would be a juror, listen to the evidence, make a decision.
You mentioned that you've been in Springfield for over 30 years. You were new to the Senate presidency. For those listening around the country, you just became the Senate president less than a month ago. This obviously in the last several years when maybe you've been dreaming and thinking about being Senate president someday, this wasn't necessarily the platform that you were looking to sort of begin your career as the leader of the state Senate. Let me ask one political sort of legislative question as it relates to your job when this decision is finally made. What are the potential long-term ramifications of this trial on the ability of the General Assembly to do the business of the people for the rest of this year?
Bruce, like Illinois, like I'm sure every state in the nation has an incredible fiscal crisis right now. And the reason why we need to have this trial done first before the regular legislative session is because obviously you can't have the both going on at the same time. But also we need to know who the governor is going to be. Is it going to be Pat Quinn, or is it going to the lieutenant governor, or is it going to be Ron Blagojevich? No matter what the outcome, we need to know that so that we can then deal with our legislative agenda, which involves a terrible financial crisis.
Do you in your mind have a timetable as to how long you think this will likely run?
We have scheduled an extra 9 days. But if it takes longer than that, we will take as much time as it takes to be fair and to do justice.
And if he is convicted, there is no appeal? And how quickly must he leave office?
I believe if he is removed from office, it's immediate by operation of law. And there's never been a successful appeal of an impeachment.
John Cullerton is the Illinois State Senate President. Tomorrow at noon, he will begin the trial of Illinois Governor Ron Blagojevich along with his colleagues in the Illinois State Senate. Senator, thank you very much for joining us tonight. I'm Bruce Dumont, back with more guests when we continue from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. And our thanks to Senate President John Cullerton for joining us for the first couple of segments this evening, offering the rules, at least the Senate's side of the story. Ron Blagojevich has been getting his share, more than his share of media coverage. And so tonight we're trying to put it in context. We now have with us, we have a Republican, we have a Democrat, liberal, conservative, we got a member of the media. We're going to have a great time. This is not the only topic we're going to be talking about this evening. But while it's fresh in everybody's mind, I want to get some reaction from everybody. First of all, Roger Keats. Roger, it's been a long time since you've been on this program. You were a longtime Illinois state senator as a Republican and as a conservative Republican. What's your reaction to what's going to happen in Springfield tomorrow?
I was going to say John Cullerton's an old friend and I wish him well, but the disingenuousness of that presentation was amazing. I'm not defending Rod Blagojevich. I never voted for Rod Blagojevich and would have never voted for Rod Blagojevich. I don't care if he's removed from office. But the point is, some of the points he made about, you know, elections are, I mean, this is how you remove people from office. No, it's not. You have elections to do this. And saying he can call any witness he wants, he can call any witness he wants. It's irrelevant. The witnesses he wants to call are the ones he's not allowed to call because Patrick Fitzgerald, and I think correctly, I understand Fitzgerald's point.
Nor is the other side, though. I mean, the other side can't call those witnesses either.
Right, but most of those witnesses, the feeling is they are beneficial to Blagojevich. And so they're crippling him. They're not crippling the Senate because the Senate's already made up their mind that they're going to bounce him because he's an embarrassment. They need to get rid of him. It was a pretty disingenuous presentation. But it's important to remember, Rod Blagojevich is not an aberration. He's normal. This is the most corrupt state in the nation. Just in my time, 5 of the last 8 elected governors have been indicted or impeached because Blagojevich is not yet indicted. I served with 2 governors who went to prison. We've sent 3 governors to prison in this time. I've served with 50 people, legislators, aldermen, Cook County judges, Cook County, Chicago elected officials who have gone to prison. In that time, over 400 city of Chicago, Cook County, and state employees have gone to prison. That is more than the other 49 states added together. This is the most corrupt state in the nation.
Salim Uwakil from In These Times. Salim, your reaction to the events that will take place in Springfield, Illinois tomorrow, and the response to Roger and also Senator Cullerton.
Well, I think that it's primarily a political kind of event, and unfortunately, I think that many of the legislators are being motivated by embarrassment. Saturday Night Live skits and whatnot, I think, figure prominently in their motives, and I agree with Roger that. Governor Blagojevich simply can't call the witnesses that he would like to help his case because he's prevented from doing that. And so there's no
other way. I mean, to speak to John Cullerton's point, when the rules were being discussed, that he never participated. He never participated in any aspect of the planning of this trial. Is there no other way that he could help himself? He certainly has rhetorical skills. He has political skills. You know, you listen to the press conference, you listen to the media interviews. I mean, he talks a mile a minute. He makes a very good case. He's been elected twice the governor of Illinois. Does he not think he can convince 20 members, you know, politicians in the state of Illinois of his innocence?
I think he's convinced that they have come to their conclusions already, and there really wouldn't be much he could offer to change their minds.
Carol Felsenthal, a veteran writer and author, nice to have you with us. Your reaction to all this brouhaha involving the governor and what Senator Cullerton had to say.
Well, first of all, I thought one thing that Senator Cullerton said that is correct is that Blagojevich should come in if he did the planning and did the work and he had a lawyer, you know, his lawyer, Ed Jensen, bowed out on Thursday or Friday. He could show tapes from the CBS Sunday show. He could gather tapes of Jesse Jackson Jr.'s press conference. He could bring all that stuff to the fore. But what he is doing is, to use a phrase that you used in the last segment, he's worrying about trying to reach the court of public opinion. I listened to the interview he did with Don Wade and Roma on WLSAM on Friday, and I thought he was incredibly compelling. He almost had me convinced that he had a good case to make. And one of the points that he made that I thought made the state Senate sound like it was not going to be fair is that they had already scheduled an end to their trial. So they weren't going to let the evidence or the issues take them where they would in a fair way, but that they had a certain number of days scheduled. Now,
although the senator said it could go longer.
Yeah, he did say that. You know, he hired a public relations agency. He is not listening to the advice of his attorneys, although this attorney, Sheldon Sirosky, who has been with Rod Blagojevich since December 9th when he was arrested, he's an interesting person to look at. I happened to have interviewed him when I was writing about Blagojevich in 2003, mm-hmm. and he's a man who is full of history and full of knows all the American presidential history as Rod Blagojevich does and has a great deal of affection for Blagojevich, and he looks like he's his main guy going forward. The PR firm is the same firm that's.
But again, I said that what I think is happening is that really, I mean, with his great political skills, and he has great political skills, great rhetorical skills. I agree with you with Don Wade and Roma. I mean, he was spinning a tail, and they were along for the ride. and I'm sure the same thing is going to happen on The View.
Well, it happened on WVON,
and
it
happened
on
WVON.
And he has a lot of support in the black community.
He has a lot of support.
Amazingly so.
So what I'm saying is that when you look at what he's doing and the shows that he's selecting, again, go back. I think he's trying to taint the jury pool.
Well,
he's looking beyond the obvious political defeat, at least as he has defined it. He is thumbing his nose at the professional politicians, which will make him and make him even a bigger hero to some people, and some of those people may get on that jury. He's planning for his date against Patrick Fitzgerald. Don't you agree with that?
Yes and no, but let me go back. We're pretending like these are independent thinkers. In the House, when it came to the initial impeachment, if Mike Madigan says, hang by your thumbs from the ceiling, 70 Democrats will hang by their thumbs from the ceiling. And in the state Senate, which, by the way, every single Democrat in that Senate has supported him time and time again, not just in elections, but remember, when his battles with Mike Madigan, it was the Senate, Nabel Jones, who always defended him. But they now realize they have gotten their marching orders that they're going to throw him out because they're tired of being embarrassed. This pretense
of
this
is who is sending their marching orders?
The Chicago Democrat machine, whether it's Mayor Daley. And again, I have nothing against Mayor Daley. I served with him. I kind of like the guy personally. But the point is, he and Mike Madigan have told them they're going to dump this guy because, frankly, they need to open up the seat for Lisa Madigan. Mike has waited long enough for her to be governor, and now she's going to be governor.
Do you think that's what's happening?
I think they're embarrassed. I think most of it is embarrassment. And I think that it's not so much the jury pool that he's attempting to take, but as Roger says, I mean, there's still some voting to be done in the Senate. And I think that many of these people can be reached by angry constituents, mm-hmm. if they voice their anger loud enough.
You know, we are almost forgetting about, in a very short period of time, the whole Roland Burris mm-hmm. appointment, which had... Yeah. I think, as Bruce seems to, that had a lot to do with the potential jury pool. There's also something
Brilliance.
About
Brilliance.
There's also something about Rod Blagojevich, and I've written about him extensively, and I've written a lot about Bill Clinton, and I looked back at his impeachment. There's something that these two guys share, and it's not only that they're great showmen and that they are charming fellows and convincing and likable, but they have no shame. Bill Clinton had no shame, and Rod Blagojevich has no shame. And people who have a more normal psyche, psychological makeup, expect that Rod Blagojevich would be hiding his head in shame, and instead he's, you know, keeping his hair up, keeping on the nice neckties, wearing the running tights, going out every morning. He is,
and he's talking about fighting for the little guy.
He's
fighting for
the
little guy, and those people are conspiring against me. They're going to raise your taxes.
I mean,
this is probably the greatest impression of Huey Long in this century, and certainly maybe even in the last century.
But a better impression of Huey than Huey.
That's right.
But nobody should overestimate.
Look what happened to Huey.
Nobody should overestimate the intelligence of the average voter. And I don't mm-hmm. mean to sound like a snob, but you can already see it with Roland Burris. Roland Burris is now being put by the leadership in the Senate on important committees. He's on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He, I believe, will be the Democrat nominated in 2010 to run for his own term. And everything that came before is already, it's out of the headlines. There are other headlines. There's Caroline Kennedy. There's this impeachment. There's everything that's going on in Washington. Roland Burris, by 2010, is going to be an elder statesman and a respected person.
But politically, because you've been in the state Senate, what if, let's say what if for just a second, what if Rod Blagojevich beats it? What does it do to the climate and the ability of him to govern the state of Illinois and for the legislature and him to get along?
It makes virtually no difference. The House will do whatever Mike Madigan says, period. There are no independents in the House and in the Senate.
But it was like 118 to 1. I mean,
But it doesn't matter. For Mike Madigan, it was 70. The Republicans are irrelevant.
Madigan, by the way, for those listening around the country, he is the Speaker of the Illinois House. He is
chairman
the chairman
of the
Democratic Party. And his daughter is the Attorney General.
And he was the co-chairman of Rod Blagojevich's re-election committee. But I want to take a step back from it on Roland Burris. Roland and I have been friends for 30 years. I don't necessarily agree with Roland. I'm a conservative Republican. Roland is a moderately liberal Democrat. But he's an honorable and decent man. And the way he was treated by Harry Reid was disgusting. Roland Burris is a decent elder statesman. And it was a brilliant choice by Blagojevich.
No question about it. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. When we come back, we're going to be talking about this other thing that happened last week. Oh, yes, we have a new president of the United States. That topic coming up next. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. The inauguration last week of Barack Obama as the 44th president of the United States, with the exception of the hitch on the oath, on which the Supreme Court justice screwed up. What's your overall view of the speech? And was it a home run or was it only a triple, in your view, Celine?
Well, you know, President Obama has this. Tendency to really lower expectations when he speaks at these grand occasions. I mean, I think about the German speech. He really could have, you know, knocked it out of the park, but he was subdued. And in this particular speech, I think he was also very subdued. And the crowd really wanted some celebratory words and some of that soaring rhetoric for which he is noted. But I think he intentionally dampened down the rhetoric because he wanted to begin lowering expectations.
When he did that, there were many who were listening to that speech, who basically they said it was okay. It was not a home run. But Roger Keats, as you look at his executive actions the next day, deciding to close Gitmo and change some of the interrogation techniques, I mean, is that the red meat that the left really needs? And is it the type of first decision that will infuriate conservatives?
You're partially accurate on that. Now, remember, I didn't vote for him, but I wish him the best. He's my president. He's my president, and I wish him the best, and it's a tough time right now. But I don't think those were good starts. Remember, I'm a retired Army colonel. I have a top-secret clearance, okay? I know a bit about some of this stuff. I don't claim to be a big expert on it, but I know a bit about it. And I can't wait till they figure out what they're going to do with these Gitmo guys. These are not a bunch of cupcakes. These are pretty rough characters. And the interrogation, I'm sorry. Gitmo, they don't call it Club Gitmo for nothing. You know, you need a vacation, you want to go to Cuba, try Club Gitmo. This pretends that this is this terrible, terrible place. Maybe at the beginning, I can't swear to that, but not today. So I think the actions have dug himself a little bit of a hole that he didn't need to dig at the beginning because he was off to a good start.
Carol, by saying that he wants to close Gitmo, but it's going to be a year from now, is it a little bit of both? I mean, you sort of throw red meat to your left wing, but you don't necessarily have to jump through hoops, and maybe a year from now becomes a year and a half.
Right. He couldn't say, I'm closing it in 30 days. And immediately after that announcement, you had the senator from Kansas saying they're not coming to Leavenworth. We don't want them here. And it's interesting because until Barack made that statement, I don't think that people thought about the practical effect of closing Gitmo.
And well, John Murtha said he wanted him in his district.
Yeah, but Nancy Pelosi didn't volunteer to take him, but Alcatraz.
Right. Yeah, although that's...
Which would have made some sense.
I've heard that suggested. You know,
but, you know, maybe
John Boehner, I don't know whether John Boehner suggested it before Nancy Pelosi said she didn't want it, but obviously it would seem to me that sending him to Alcatraz would be the logical place because certainly if you're going to change their interrogation techniques, they're going to be on the island off San Francisco. So if any of them ever escaped, they certainly would find friends in San Francisco, would they not?
It'd be a little hard to get in.
I think
realistically,
that, no. I think he had to do this. This was a dark stain against American values, and many people around the world were just itching for someone to come along and say we have to deal with this.
Then
we can't keep these gulags
or torture
chambers.
How come he didn't know where they
chambers.
Were going to go?
Well, I mean, because many of the prisoners are. People who were picked up off the street, they were collected through bounties given to folks who.
No, but here's my point.
I'm not sure
if
that's
you know
a
you're
fair
if you know you're going to do this, which obviously he's had a while for transition. Mm-hmm. He knew he was going to do it. He said it during the campaign. He knew at some point they were going to do it. Why don't you have the answer to the question, where do they go, before you announce you're going to pull the plug?
Because the camp itself had to be closed. We figure out what to do with these people after that terrible stain is erased. Because
you just change things at Gitmo? In other words, stay at Gitmo if the conditions are changed.
The reason
if
that
the
they,
interrogation
it's
techniques
a country
are
club
changed,
now. How much more can you
the
change?
The reason that they are in Gitmo is because Lindo, they're outside.
Everybody.
They're outside of the continental United States, yeah. And so they don't have to abide by the kinds of restrictions that they would have to abide by.
But we've held prisoners of war outside. The mistake George Bush made, it was a mistake. He did not declare them prisoners of war. They are prisoners of war. And the same people criticizing Gitmo never seem to be able to criticize Franklin Roosevelt when he put thousands of American citizens of Japanese descent in prisoner of war camps,
yeah,
as far as we can criticize.
Not
the people questioning Gitmo.
But they, you know, there's also been some news stories that have popped up over the last week or so about Gitmo releasees who are now busy working for Al Qaeda. So you have those.
Absolutely.
Well, that's an exaggerated number.
I'm not surprised he made that.
What constitutional rights? These are not American citizens.
It's not surprising that Barack Obama made that announcement because it was something that he promised through the race for the nomination and then in the general election, that he doesn't have the details worked out. That doesn't surprise me at all. He gave himself a year to do it, and he's got a national security team, most of which is in place, and they'll have to figure
now
it out.
Now, also, the current issue of Chicago Magazine, you have written a wonderful cover story on Michelle Obama, Michelle, a Chicago story, and you did the research. She didn't give you an interview.
No.
But in give us for the 30-second version, what was your impression of talking? You talked to 50 people.
55.
What's your impression? 55.
Right.
What's your impression of her?
I think that she is, the word that's most used to describe her is grounded. I think that she, to use a cliched and sexist expression, wears the pants in the family. And she likes nice things. There was an interesting story this morning that we already blogged about.
We got to pause. Again, it's the current issue of Chicago Magazine. We will be back in hour number two. If you're listening to us on radio, we'll carry on this conversation. Also, we got a full board of lights. We will take those calls as well. And also, in the next hour, we're going to talk more about not only Governor Blagojevich, but also we're going to talk about President Obama and all the decisions he's made in week number one of the Obama administration. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway, tonight featuring commentary by conservative Roger Keats, liberal Salim Muakil of In These Times, and writer Carol Felsenthal. And our phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. In this hour, we're going to be talking about the inauguration of Barack Obama. And also, if you have questions that you want to comment on Rod Blagojevich and his impending trial before the Illinois State Senate tomorrow. We'll take calls on that subject as well. But I want to talk more about Barack Obama and what he's done in the first week. And, you know, obviously there's been a lot of discussion. Certainly the decision to close Guantanamo has dominated a lot of news, at least insofar as the conservative talk radio is concerned. So on one hand, you throw something to your left-wing base, which may make them happy, and you throw something to the right-wing talk show hosts, and they've got something to talk about.
Right.
However, the big issue appears to be the economy and the stimulus package that is going to dominate news for the next several months. And my question to you, Roger Keats, because you are both a political animal and also you spent a lot of years toiling in the financial markets, what's your reaction to the Obama stimulus plan?
The same as my reaction to George Bush's stimulus plan. Stupid idea. Let me put a historical perspective, and this is what's important. When Ronald Reagan replaced Jimmy Carter, prime was 21.5. It's now around 4. Unemployment rate was 12.5. Our unemployment rate's now at 7-something. Mortgages were 18%. They're now at 5. And the Russians were dominating the world, and the Iranians were holding the entire American embassy staff for 444 days. I wish Barack Obama well, but let's not pretend like we've never seen this before. Let's ask what Ronald Reagan and Paul Volcker, who was instrumental at that time, did to get us out of the mess. And rather than increasing government, what they in reality did was try to slow it down, limit it, lower the inflation rate, which at the moment inflation is not a problem. But the other issue we have to remember is free trade. The largest exporting nation of the world is not China. It's America. And right now you're about to have not only massive stimulus plans that are going to cause inflation in the long run, but we've got people who are just anti-free markets and free trade. Well, if you're the largest exporting nation of the world, who do you think is going to get their throat slit when we start limiting trade? Mm-hmm. And even the number two trading nation is not China. The number two trading nation exporter is in reality Germany. So we'll be hurting our own friends. So the answer is the direction he's going, I think it's the same mistake George Bush made, which is why many of us who consider ourselves free market conservatives are more than happy to see George Bush gone.
Salim, your reaction to the economic stimulus plan?
Well, most of the experts who I've been reading seem to have reached the consensus that we need some serious stimulus like in this particular direction. In fact, there may be even more necessary in areas like food stamps and unemployment insurance. And the Republicans are balking a bit at that. I think President Obama's insistence on being bipartisan is giving the Republicans this opening, and they're really using it very, very adroitly. I think that normally the vanquished party would, you know, go into a corner and kind of sulk for a little while, and the Democrats could, you know, work their show and dominate the discussion. But what's happening is because of Barack's insistence on being so bipartisan, he's giving the Republicans a chance to make their arguments in ways that they really shouldn't be doing right
now. Carol, your reaction to the way that he's handled at least the first week on two big issues, obviously Gitmo and also
the economic stimulus package?
Well, I think he's coming up, like as he did on Gitmo, with the question about what to do with these prisoners. He's also coming up against John McCain now, which I'm finding to be an interesting phenomenon, because McCain and Barack Obama were best buddies. I mean, Barack threw McCain a party and toasted him. I think it was just before the inauguration. And now the last I've heard from McCain is he said, I'm not going to be a handmaiden to Barack Obama. He disagrees with some basic tenets of that plan. Barack Obama also has to deal with the important question of Tim Geithner, and whether he's going to be confirmed as Treasury Secretary. He seems to be in some trouble.
Right. We're going to go to some telephone calls. We have problems with our call screening system tonight. So what we're going to do is we're going to go to a call, and so put a call on the air, and I will say hello to them and find out who are you and where are you calling from.
Hello. My name is Mark. I'm calling from Eureka, California.
Okay. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah. Obama passed a number of executive orders this past week. One of them pertained to ethics and lobbying.
Right.
And it's a little discouraging for me that he's already appointed the number two man to Pentagon, who's been a lobbyist for Raytheon. His name is David Lynn.
Right.
But he drafted a waiver to get around his executive order. So, but considering the amount of what seems to be war profiteering that's gone on at the Pentagon, I think it's unfortunate that there already seems to be an exception which points to hypocrisy, especially given no big contracts at the Pentagon. And just one more point about ethics. And Geithner was mentioned. Now, for 4 years, he didn't pay taxes. He was audited by the IRS. He paid the 2 years the IRS audited. However, he knew he still owed on the two other years that he wasn't audited on. However, he did not pay until he knew he was going to be appointed to be Treasury Secretary. So I would say it's another ethical lapse.
So you think he's off to a flying stop on a couple of big issues?
Well, concerning change and ethics and lobbying and the kind of corrupt influence of big money and big business and politics, I'd say he's staying the course of Bush.
All right, listen, we're going to move on. Let's go to Tony in South Bend, Indiana, calling on line 3. You're on the air. Tony, go ahead.
Hello?
Tony, go ahead.
My name's Jeff.
Okay, Jeff, you sound like Tony. Go ahead.
All right, anyway, my thing is about Blagojevich, and I have a theory that possibly could mitigate his circumstances. Quite simply, I've heard your panelists and other people like Mayor Daley say he's a kook. Panelists tonight talked.
He says he's cuckoo, cuckoo.
Something. Well, if there truly is a problem with psychology, then how about if you get the DNC to create a panel of psychiatric experts to screen and vet these candidates before you put them up as a gubernatorial nominee? So what I'm suggesting for Blagojevich to do is sue the DNC because they put him up as a gubernatorial candidate without screening him.
The DNC didn't do it. I mean, his father-in-law, Dick Mell, put him up. And he waged a very strong campaign, raised a lot of money. And then when he was running for re-election, he raised even more money. He took a decent, honest Republican, longtime elected official and made her, made mincemeat out of her with the money in destroying her credibility. I mean, that's what the guy does. I mean, his ability to raise money, I do not put it past him, the ability to raise a lot of money if he ran again. In his mind, he thinks he can be reelected governor. I totally believe that.
You know, it's interesting because we're talking now here on the 25th of January about the possibility of Rod Blagojevich surviving this. Back on December 9th when he was arrested, he seemed like, as John Cass of the Chicago Tribune calls him, dead meat.
Well, again,
but he doesn't. He seems like he's in there's a possibility of resurrecting.
I want to get, we're taking phone calls both on Obama and on Blagojevich, 1-800-723-8289. We're flying a little bit blind on our calls tonight, but one thing we do know, the phones do work. We just don't know who we're talking to, so give us a call. It could be you. Next, live from Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont. From Fresno, California to Augusta, Georgia, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. Let's go to Watson listening to us on KLBJ. Go ahead. You're on the air, Watson.
Yes. Listen to Mark.
Yes.
Yes. I wanted to know, has any federal judge or state judge ever stepped in and stopped the legislature for trying to impeach a governor on maybe grounds of fairness? And the second question was, what evidence are they going to be able to present? Because unless the attorney general turned over everything he had to whoever was presenting the case against him, I don't see what more they could tell us, the public, that he's done that would be grounds for impeaching him.
Well, first of all, let me just say that most of the people, and again, you may be an exception, Watson, but most of the people that are listening to this program beyond Chicago and beyond Illinois are hearing the abbreviated issues involving Blagojevich. First of all, they're hearing about transcripts of conversations he's had basically within the last 8 to 12 weeks.
You mean excerpts of
excerpts of those transcripts. They are not hearing some of the specific things that the federal government has been investigating. Now, there's a lot of people that don't know exactly what they've been investigating, although they've been on his trail for about 3.5 years. So they think they have maybe even longer than that. So the public does not know that. What the Illinois General Assembly have rendered a verdict on, at least as far as the House is concerned, 118-1. They think there's enough evidence about wrongdoing by Governor Blagojevich in the operations of the state of Illinois that they voted to impeach him. Now, that evidence is now going to go to the state Senate, but most of that evidence, and again, we will hear about it in the next several weeks when the trial unfolds, but I would say that most of that evidence is not something that people beyond Illinois have read anything about or very little about.
Okay, so there's more out there.
Yes. Well, the general belief is that there's a lot more out there, not only insofar as the impeachment is concerned, but also insofar as a federal indictment is concerned. And again, the governor has not yet been indicted. He hasn't even been indicted based on the charges of his arrest in early December. And, the U.S. attorney has asked for additional time to build his case against the governor. In the meantime, in the only court where the governor can basically operate right now, and that's the court of public opinion, he is a master in the court of public opinion. He's been elected and reelected to governor of the fifth largest state.
Can I say something to yes. Ms. Watson? Because he's a terrible governor. He's hopelessly inept. But the Illinois voters knew that, and they reelected him. So now the legislature is saying, look, anyone in the state who didn't know that he was ethically challenged for the 2006 election was probably the E student sleeping in the back of the classroom. Everyone knew this. But I want to put a different spin on this, and I'm going to give my wife, who's an excellent political analyst, credit for this. She thinks when Fitzgerald called and arrested him and called off the investigation, that in reality he was protecting Barack Obama. Not that Barack Obama was corrupt. Let me finish, because at first it'll sound different than what I'm saying is. It's that Fitzgerald, who is not a Republican by any stretch of the imagination, did not want the president's administration to start under a cloud. Not that President Obama had done anything, but Rahm Emanuel, who is very close to Rod Blagojevich, the same congressional seat, have been friends for years. And if you think Rod Blagojevich's language is a little graphic, he's a patsy compared to Rahm Emanuel. And Blagojevich was talking to all these people in the administration. Even if they said nothing wrong, it is never to your benefit to have your voice recorded by the federal prosecutors. And my wife, and I think she was correct, was saying, Fitzgerald just said, we cannot afford to have the president crippled. Even if the president had done nothing wrong, it's the embarrassment.
So it's your wife's suggestion that if they would have kept talking,
something would have come up.
Rahm might have said something that would have incriminated.
Anyone who's ever dealt with Rahm Emanuel a long time would say, we're amazed he hadn't said something yet.
Salim?
Yeah, I think that's right. I really do. I agree with your wife, Roger. I mean, Fitzgerald himself said he wanted to stop a crime in process. And I think that was the crime he was alluding to, potential crime.
He was alluding to the sale of the Senate seat to the highest bidder. Mm-hmm. And that's what the national audience knows. Now, what the legislature should have done was had a recall amendment, and that's how Blagojevich should have been taken from office. You know, the last governor in the United States to be impeached is Meacham of Arizona. And when he had his criminal trial, he was exonerated. He was found not guilty, you know. And I think what that theory that your wife is espousing, and I've thought about it and I've heard other people talking about it, Rahm Emanuel, who I've interviewed several times for the profiles that I've done, not only is every other word the F word, that's everybody knows that, but he, whoever it was that I was writing about, Bill Daley or Rod Blagojevich or Bill Clinton, he was always their best friend. He always said that to me. You know, I talk to him every day. I think something would have come up. You know, who knows? But anyway, it's...
In a sense...
And Fitzgerald is known as a Republican, by the way.
Oh, no,
but
I don't think so.
I think that's the way the general public sees him, as more on the conservative side of the...
I don't think most people think him as...
And also extremely honest.
Yeah, but he overreached, though, I think, in his rhetoric announcing this.
We're going to take another call. Let's go to Jim in South Elgin, listening to us on WLS. You're on the air.
Good evening. I was calling before about... I was hoping the Illinois senator would still been on. You know, the governor of Illinois had manipulated the pension plans where he was taking non-pension plan money and using it for other purposes, therefore kind of robbing the pension receivers, if you will, of their money. I was wondering if that's something he could be impeached for, he'd been impeached on.
No, and you're asking a great question, and this is Roger, a former legislator. Illinois is, my understanding, we have the largest unfunded pension deficit of any state, and we're number one in bonded indebtedness. The trouble is when you're an elected official, doing corrupt, stupid, and incompetent things is legal. You're elected to make actions, and if they're corrupt, stupid, and incompetent, that's what you were elected for. And the simple fact is what has happened to the Illinois pension funds in the last 10 years is a scandal that is almost beyond comprehension. You're talking about we have a systemic $2.5 to $5 billion budget deficit. Just the difference of what Blagojevich is spending to what's coming in for revenues, and that doesn't include the pension deficits, doesn't include the bond problems. Illinois is in a financial mess. We are a financial cesspool. And Blagojevich and George Ryan before him, this last decade has all but destroyed Illinois' finances.
Let's take another call. Go ahead. Tell us who you are and where you're calling from. Hello, are you there?
This is John from Chicago.
Yes, John, go ahead.
Either you have the rule of law or you have mob rule. And, Salim, maybe you're the best one there to recognize a lynching when you see one. The precise reason they're going with the impeachment is precisely to avoid giving Rod due process with real witnesses and real depositions and real discovery. I mean, if all they have to do if they say that they can't give them the witnesses now is here's a concept, let the court case go first and then do the impeachment later. You know, you talk about tainting the jury, but what has the media been doing for the last several weeks? But pillorying Rod without giving him the chance to call witnesses or give due process. How is that fair?
Well, I think Fitzgerald tainted the jury more than anyone else when he made those announcements about the Lincoln's turning over in his grave and all of that.
Exactly, but Roger was exactly right on why he did it, precisely to protect Jesse and Valerie and Rahm and, by extension, Obama. That's precisely why. All he had to do is wait 2 days until they had the announcement that Jesse was going to be, you know, appointed and take them both. He didn't do that.
I do agree with you that both sides, I mean, obviously, in the press conference, again, the U.S. attorney went pretty far down the road. He painted a picture. You had so much so that Harry Reid went on TV and said, well, obviously everybody knows that Blagojevich is corrupt. Mm-hmm. I mean, here's the leader of the United States Senate saying on Meet the Press, offering his opinion. And then you have the governor. Frankly, I'm a little bit surprised that it took the governor so long to go on the offensive. However, look at the timing.
It's perfect.
Perfect timing on the eve of the trial beginning. He goes on with Don Wade and Roma on WLS, which has a large blue collar collar audience. Mm-hmm. He goes on Cliff Kelly, which has a large African-American audience. Tomorrow he's going to go on Good Morning America, which is the top-rated morning show, certainly the top-rated morning show in Chicago on the national level. Then he's going to go on The View, which all the women are going to be watching. Right. And then tomorrow night he's going to go on with Larry King, which is all the old people are going to be watching. So
demographics.
These selections of the shows that he's going on, in my view, it's not coincidental. The one other thing which I'd love to know about is you generally can't go on the Today Show and Good Morning America.
But he did. He's doing both.
He taped the Today Show.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But he taped the Today Show, and I think they announced that he had been taped after Good Morning America began to promote that he was going to be on. Mm-hmm. So he sort of trapped Good Morning America to do the interview with Diane Sawyer. So, he probably is not making friends at either show.
He had to do Good Morning America in order to get on The View, is the way that I understand it. But, at the beginning, first of all, Fitzgerald and that press conference, which is the press conference for the ages, I think. I've never seen anything like it. But he did seem to lapse into hyperbole, and there is a question about whether that has tainted him, to use the word taint. Right. And at the beginning, I thought, and I've spent a lot of time with Blagojevich writing about him, I thought what he was doing was preparing for the insanity defense. But he seems to outsmart everybody. Look at the way he appointed Roland Burris, and then compare it now with the way that the governor of New York, Patterson, screwed up the appointment of Caroline Kennedy and appointed somebody who's got 100% rating from the NRA, and he has everybody up in arms over him.
Dumb like a fox.
Yeah, I think he knew what he was doing.
Back shortly, 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. You're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Your calls when we roll on. 1-800-723-8029. From Sweetwater, Tennessee to Fresno, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289 from coast to coast and border to border on America's great radio stations, as well as XM and Sirius satellite radios. Salim Mulkill is here this evening. He's our liberal. He's the senior columnist, senior editor of In These Times, one of the country's leading progressive periodicals, a longtime friend of Barack Obama's. Indeed. Also joining us this evening is Roger Keats. For many, many years, he was an Illinois state senator. He did not serve with Barack Obama, but he spent many years in Springfield. And he's a conservative Republican from the North Shore, and he was recently given an award for Black History Month. Now, how does a conservative Republican from the North Shore get a Black History Month award, Roger?
Because sometimes,
in 50 words or less, please. Give us the short version.
That's an unrealistic goal.
How about 75?
After all the corruption of Operation Greylord, when, as usual, we set the record for most hundred-some judges, lawyers, et cetera, going to jail, we realized the crooks weren't black, weren't Hispanic, and weren't Republican. So we put together a coalition to clean out the crooks. And, of course, the Democrat Party fought us every step of the way, but the black and Hispanic legislators and the Republicans, 75% of the votes were Republican, and we put more black and Hispanic judges on the bench than at any time in the history of America. And we as Republicans knew we were doing it, supplied 75% of the votes to do it, but we did it working together for both the opportunity for minority judges, which almost did not exist in Cook County before that, and also for the corruption, because, as I say, the guys going to jail weren't black, Hispanic, or Republican.
So you were reaching across the aisle long before it was fashionable.
Long before.
Carol Felsenthal also joins us. She has written the cover story on Michelle, a Chicago story. That's in Chicago Magazine on our First Lady, Michelle Obama. And also, she wrote the most recent book on Bill Clinton in exile. And let's just take a moment before we go back to calls. I mean, Hillary Clinton is now ensconced. She is the new Secretary of State of the United States. And all of the effort, all of the research that went into your book about who contributed to the Clinton Library and all of the potential real and perceived skullduggery that you discovered, are you a little bit depressed that the Secretary of State is Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton is probably going to still receive some benefit from all of the millions and millions of dollars that people have stuffed in his pockets?
I'll tell you what I was discouraged by, and that was her confirmation hearing, where she ruled the roost completely. The Republicans just rolled over and didn't question her about the arrangement that Bill Clinton made with the Obama administration to report the contributions that he's getting to his foundation and to his library and to his Clinton Global initiative. And what she said to them with an icy stare was, this has all been determined and it was worked out between the Obama administration and my husband, and, you know, don't ask anymore. And they didn't. And I thought it is, I think there is a real possibility for problems in that. And since her confirmation hearing, there was a front page story in the New York Times about a developer, and I think in Syracuse, New York, who was giving a lot of money to Bill Clinton, and Hillary Clinton was helping with some legislation when she was senator from New York. I think it's a hornet's nest, and I think that, you know, the Clintons have emerged on top. And Bill Clinton is a loose cannon, and he is going to be involved one way or another because he needs to be in the limelight. The only time recently...
So he's the gift that's going to keep giving to Republicans and to investigative
journalists. For journalists and for the paperback version of my book, which is out in May or June. Seriously, because the only time you saw him when he looked happy was when he was holding the Bible when Hillary was confirmed. Why did he look happy? Because he was directly in the camera range and he got to preen for the camera. He did not come to her confirmation hearing, and it was because he wasn't going to sit there and look at the back of her head for 8 hours. And also, I think he probably would have fallen asleep because it wasn't about him.
One of the things that that was upset some Republicans, not a lot, but some Republicans, and certainly it was referenced by the media commentators and the anchors, was some of the harsh words that although the Bush administration was not mentioned, George Bush was sitting just about 3 feet away from Barack Obama when he basically very adeptly, I think, but very firmly took a swipe at the Bush administration during the inaugural speech. This was when he spoke in ways that seemed to strongly suggest that the Bush policy was really screwed out. Here is an example of where he links the Bush administration with the sacrifice of American ideals.
As for our common defense, we reject as false the choice between our safety and our ideals. Our founding fathers, faced with perils that we can scarcely imagine, drafted a charter to assure the rule of law and the rights of man, a charter expanded by the blood of generations. Those ideals still light the world, and we will not give them up for expedience's sake. And so, to all the other peoples and governments who are watching today, from the grandest capitals to the small village where my father was born, know that America is a friend of each nation and every man, woman, and child who seeks a future of peace and dignity, and we are ready to lead once more.
Okay. That was the rhetoric. Then there was the decision that Gitmo was going to be closed, and the change in the hearings and the way in which people are going to be interrogated using the Army Field Manual. When you hear those words, how do you think they were received in foreign capitals, Celine?
With great joy. I think that's one of the reasons why he had to close Gitmo, or at least announce that he was going to close Gitmo, is because of that notion that we can protect ourselves, we can be safe, and still adhere to principles that had people around the world looking up to this country for its devotion to the rule of law.
How do we know that?
How do we know what?
How do we know that we can protect ourselves, protect
the
American people without doing what basically, if I can just finish, without doing what we have been doing for the last 5 years?
We're going to have to do it because we can't live in a hypocritical zone and expect to be respected around the world. We will continue to reap the kind of disrespect and disfavor that we have during the tenure of George Bush if we do not try to adjust
it is wishful thinking. I mean, the reality is, it is wishful thinking that in this mean world out there, and there are people, you know, who do want to kill us.
Well, as Barack pointed out, it's always been mean. It was very mean when the Founding Fathers came on the scene. And yet, although it was mean, they managed to construct
principles.
It wasn't
mean like Al-Qaeda mean.
Well, Every enemy we face, we always say, is an unprecedented enemy.
Well, it is, isn't it?
Al-Qaeda is a cult. We're the ones who bolstered.
No, but I'm saying that terrorist attack and killing innocent individuals and the ability of smart bombs going in that could destroy an American city. I mean, that didn't exist, you know, in 1776. I mean, the world is a meaner place, and the potential to kill people is a meaner place. And what I'm saying is that you may be right. I mean, I said in the final night of the Bush administration last week on our program that I hope that Barack Obama is able to say at the end of 4 years or 8 years as president, I hope he's going to be able to say exactly what George Bush is: there's not been another terrorist attack in the United States. And if he makes these changes and nothing happens, then I will say on this program, as I've said for 4.5 years now, thank God for Barack Obama and the Attorney General for protecting us. Okay. But you know what? Until he's equaled George Bush's record, I'm not going to throw George Bush's record of protecting us out, even though, in some cases, he perhaps went a little bit too far. The end result is, we have been protected.
Well, but we don't know if there's a cause and effect there.
We do too. Wait, let me say something. When they say we're not respected in the world, look, America represents something that 150 nations in the UN don't believe in. These are dictatorships. These are kingdoms. These are countries where human rights, where in Islamic countries where women are not even given the most basic and minimal rights. They hate what we stand for. And Barack Obama, and I say this not to embarrass him, I say he can kiss them all he wants. They're not going to like what America stands for. We stand for freedom. They don't. There are 150 countries in the UN who are opposed to everything we believe in.
But one thing that he said, he also tried, the president when he was talking, said that he wants to set a strong tone against terrorism and foreign threats in that speech as well.
As for our common defense, we reject as false the choice between our safety and our ideals. Our founding fathers, faced with perils that we can scarcely imagine, drafted a charter to assure the rule of law.
That was the cut that you just heard, so let's go to the other cut, cut two. Let's hear what he has to say about terrorism.
Apologize for our way of life, nor will we.
Well, we're having a little problem tonight, so let's go to calls. Let's go to yes, go ahead.
One more thing. I wanted to say, too, when you're talking about the speech that Barack Obama gave, and I'm not defending George Bush. As a conservative, limited government Republican, once you get past defending the nation and the Supreme Court, there's not much you can defend from his record. But compare it to Ronald Reagan, who just followed Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, Herbert Hoover, and James Buchanan, the guy just before the Civil War, are clearly the three worst presidents in American history. And Ronald Reagan was gracious enough not to turn to him and say, by the way, you idiot. I mean, you look at the mess Jimmy Carter made of the world, made of the United States and of the Middle East, the stupid things he had done. But Ronald Reagan was gracious. I don't disagree with some of what Barack Obama was saying. But I think as a courtesy, Republicans have not done that. You didn't see George Bush turning to Bill Clinton and say a few of those things.
We're going to hear that when we come back. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's head to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where Darren is listening to us on WRNN. Go ahead. Are you there? Darren on line two, are you there? You're not. How about Mrs. Murphy on line four from Plainfield?
Hi, how are you?
Mrs. Murphy, how you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm just about ready to go out and replenish my gas tank. I've just discovered I'm down on E, and I couldn't get to church today.
Okay.
But, however, I wanted to give you a little bit of my chowder. Mrs. Okay. Murphy Strouder, you've
yes,
heard of that.
Yes, I understand.
Yes, I am against the what they call the stimulus. I think it's a poor example for the United States to be following in the path of the blunder boy, Blunder Boy gave us $300 at one time and $300 another time. That money is going to go for whatever people think they should have. To begin with, I am from the Depression area. I hate to tell you how old I am, or I should. Okay, I was just 82. But here's the thing. I lived through the Depression. Now, that money is going to go for naught. What we should do with it is do what President Roosevelt did. And I know you're all going to poo-poo it, and you're turning your nose up at President Roosevelt. However, you put the money into something that's going, where you're going to get something back from it. Put the men to work, and in the in, at the other end of the process, you are giving us a new structure in the government, railroads, streets. You know, WPA, Works Progress Administration, covered a myriad of examples. We had
all right. Let's let Roger Keats, who's our conservative Republican.
Okay.
Tell us why you don't think a WPA would work now.
Well, number one is every honest economist will tell you that from the time Franklin Roosevelt took office, and he continued many of the policies of Herbert Hoover, who was a disaster,
right.
The economy not only hadn't gotten better, it got worse. And by 1940, if we hadn't had World War II to get us out, we'd have still been in the Depression. The WPA and all of that huge spending did not in any way get us out of the Depression. Every economic statistic will show you that things had not gotten better, in many cases got worse. If what you really wanted to do was stimulate the economy, if you really want to run this deficit, and I'm opposed to it, but if you really were going to, I'd say, why don't you just cut out the income tax this year? It's about the same size as the $1 trillion, and let the taxpayer decide how do we want to get the economy going again. We're so busy having the government pick winners or losers. One of the big problems in the Roosevelt era was they picked people to be winners who were in reality losers. And so it didn't function. Let the people
who own the money decide.
Yes. Go ahead, Mrs. Murphy.
Yes, but in the end, we had our infrastructure renewed. We had better streets, better sidewalks, and everything else that came with it, because we put men to work. I happen to know people who worked and built Northerly Island. Did you know, remember when our Northerly Island was just part of the lake and it was filled? It was a landfill.
Your point is that WPA is popular with lots of people. We're going to move on and take another call. Eduardo, listening to us on WLS, you're on Coast to Coast.
Yeah. What we need to do is we should have executed these Guantanamo detainees a long time ago instead of sending them to Saudi Arabia to get art therapy.
Salim, do you have a comment on that?
He's being facetious, right? I mean, he can't
Eduardo,
possibly
are you
be
being
serious.
Facetious about that? You think that everybody at Gitmo should be done away with, executive
yeah,
action,
because
all of them?
They have no rights. They're not covered on the Geneva Convention. I know Mr. Malik would think otherwise, but they're not under the Geneva Convention. I know a lot of liberals like to think that, but...
Well, you know what? I want to go back. I want to spend just the remaining time we have and stay on the line, if you will, because I want to go back to something we discussed in the third segment of our program when we talked about the decision on Gitmo, and that is where should these people go? You've got the most dangerous people in the world, allegedly. Where do they go?
Alcatraz.
Nancy Pelosi doesn't want them at Alcatraz. John Murtha has said he wants them in his district. I'd love to see them go. John Murtha deserves them in his district.
First of all, we need to determine who's a threat. We haven't even done that. We haven't given them a chance to question any kind of evidence
in
that
the
we
next
have.
Year. In the next year, we will determine that.
Yes. You know,
Obama
and then we can make a decision where they should go. Most of them are innocent, but they were picked up off the street.
Now, that I don't agree with at all. But I want to stress, because our caller, and I apologize, I missed the name, you made a brilliant point.
Eduardo.
You made a brilliant point. I'm a retired Army colonel with a top secret clearance. I was a security manager of a division. I used to do the briefings on the Geneva Convention. And you are 1,000% correct. These guys are not covered. There are several key issues involved. In order to be covered by the Geneva Convention, number one, you have to be a soldier representing a country. Number two, you got to wear a uniform. And number three, you have to adhere to the standards of the convention. Mm-hmm. Well, if you are murdering women and children, and if you do not represent a country, and you don't wear a uniform, and you're a terrorist, you're not covered by it.
They're automatically terrorists. That, to me, that is such an absurd conclusion. Because they don't have a uniform, they are automatically being less human than other people.
No, they don't represent a country. And they murder women and children. They behead people left and right. They blow up bombs. We do not do that.
What do you think 100-ton bombs do to people when we drop them on civilian communities? That's not murdering women and children?
We do not intentionally drop
them. Oh, we don't intentionally do it. Oh, sure. I mean, see, this is what gets me. We have this selective kind of morality where we can bomb as many people as we want from the air. Massacre as many people as we want, and we don't consider that.
We are
that.
Not massacring people. This is a war, Roger. And these terrorists Roger. Intentionally use women and children as shelters. They use them as shields. They are intentionally
the
killing their
from
own
Iraq
people.
That from the shock and awe that we the civilian deaths that we perpetrated. It's really amazing that we can sit back and claim other people are murderers while we continue to murder people with bombs.
On that note, we have to say farewell, and I can predict that since we're not going to have an answer to Gitmo for another year, this topic will come back and visit us again and again. I still think it's probably a good idea to send him to Alcatraz, but of course the speaker does not like that idea. So maybe you want to send us some suggestions as to where you think the prisoners might go, because that is a major decision that the President of the United States, and of course you've got 50 people saying, 50 states saying, well, I don't want them here, I don't want them here. But
well,
somebody's going
to
get them.
I mean, you don't want to put them in
somebody,
a group.
Somebody's going to get them unless you clean up Gitmo. Maybe you change Gitmo's name and they stay at Gitmo and you just change the rules.
You can't clean it up anymore. It's a country club.
We have got to move on. Our thanks to Roger Keats, our conservative Republican, Salim Muwakkil, our liberal tonight from In These Times, and Carol Felsenthal, who's authored the book on Bill Clinton, Clinton in Exile, and also the cover story in Chicago Magazine, Michelle, A Chicago Story. Our program is out of time. Our thanks to Tom Vera Cruz and Ben Stewart for being with us. See you next Sunday night.